If you like audiobooks or audio shows, check out a free trial of Audible. Just click the link in the description.
Welcome to Mindshock True Crime. This is Bruce McGuire here with
Natural Powers
and Sid Irwin.
And we need Sid Irwin's Mensa mind, or the mind that was too intelligent for Mensa. Did I get that right, Sid?
Yes, I'll let it slide.
For this case, which is one of the most bizarre disappearances of all time, it is the case that has been requested time and time again. That is the disappearance of Brian Schaefer. And this one has boggled or mind-shocked quite a few minds out there. And we will attempt to decipher what exactly happened and the different scenarios and theories intertwined in this incredibly bizarre, vanished in the blink of an eye case. As always, if you like the podcast, you can donate to our PayPal. Just check the link in the description. Make sure you subscribe to the channel. Hit the bell for notifications. If you like the podcast, hit the like button. Feel free to share it across social media platforms like our Facebook page. You could also check us out, Twitter, Reddit, Patreon. Any thoughts, questions, comments, theories of your own, feel free to discuss in the comments section. There are a lot of very astute amateur sleuths out there online who rival those of professionals in their critical thinking, deductive reasoning, and mastering of logic in thinking about cases in different ways that law enforcement or private detectives might not have thought of. And that is what we will attempt to do here, to approach this from every single angle. So have you guys heard of this case before I brought it up or no?
I have not.
What about you, Sid?
No, I have not.
All right, so I'm going to actually read this article on Medium by Brenda Thornlow. She posted this November 8th, 2017. It's a really, really good background on the case. She has a disclaimer. My theories on this case are simply conjecture, my own personal opinions. I am not in law enforcement, nor am I a private investigator. I'm only here to share my thoughts, take them for what they are. Born on February 25th, 1979, Brian Schaefer was the oldest of Randy and Renee Schaefer's two sons. Having grown up in Pickerington, Ohio, Brian graduated from high school in 1997, and attended Ohio State University for his undergraduate studies, graduating 6 years later with a degree in microbiology. In 2004, Brian began studies at Ohio State University College of Medicine, OSU. Despite his interest in pursuing a medical career, Brian often expressed that his real dream was to start a band and play music along the genre of Jimmy Buffett. He had always been attracted to the laid-back vibe and lifestyle of tropical locations. You're a big Jimmy Buffett fan, Maxwell, right?
Yeah, I don't know who he is.
What about Sid? Do you know Jimmy Buffett?
Yes, but never really listened to his music.
Come on, guys. He's pretty awesome. All right. In 2006, during spring break of Brian's second year of medical school, he and his girlfriend and fellow medical student, Alexis Wagoner, planned a trip to Miami where many believed Brian was going to propose. By all accounts, the future looked promising for the 27-year-old medical student. He was doing well in his classes and had a thriving social life. However, in March of that same year, Brian's mother, Renee, would pass from myelodysplasia, a form of bone marrow cancer. Brian was very close to his mother, and although he, understandably, took her death hard, those close to him claimed he was handling it well. I suppose as well as anyone who has lost a parent could. Friday, March 31st, marked the end of classes at OSU and the beginning of spring break. Exams were over, and Brian initially planned to celebrate that night with his brother, Derek. When Derek and his wife canceled their plans with Brian, he then arranged to go out later with his friend, William Clint Florence. Prior to meeting up with Clint, Brian met his father, Randy, for dinner. That evening, Randy noticed that his son looked exhausted, which didn't seem that unusual given that he had pulled some all-nighters earlier in the week, cramming for exams. I'm sure dealing with the grief from his mother's passing only weeks before had also taken a toll on Brian. The elder of the two men had some reservations about Brian going out that night with Clint, but kept these concerns to himself. At 9 p.m., Brian met Clint at the Ugly Tuna Saluna, a seafood restaurant and bar located on the second floor of South Campus Gateway Complex on High Street. Have you guys ever been there?
Sadly, no. I've not had an opportunity to be a patron there.
You got to get that to the top of your list immediately. Actually, it's actually been closed since then. But an hour later, he called Alexis, who was visiting her family in Toledo, and told her he loved her. Throughout the rest of the night, Brian and Clint visited several other bars, working their way down to the Arena District. According to Clint, the duo had one shot of hard liquor at each establishment. After midnight, they ran into Clint's friend Meredith Reed, who gave them both a ride back to the Ugly Tuna, where a live band was playing. The three were caught on CCTV cameras at 1:15 a.m., riding the escalator up to the restaurant bar. At some point, Brian separated from his friends. Some online sources claim that he told Clint and Meredith that he was going to talk to one of the members of the band. But all that is known is that, again, on camera around 1:55 a.m., Brian was seen outside the bar speaking briefly with two young women and then moved off camera to re-enter the bar. When the bar closed at 2 a.m., Clint and Meredith noticed that Brian was nowhere to be seen. They searched for him within the massive swarm of people that were exiting. Then, after a while, the two assumed he had gone home without telling them. And by the way, his apartment is only about a half a mile from the Ugly Tuna Saluna. So a couple blocks. I'm not entirely sure if there is any evidence showing that Clint and or Meredith tried calling him on his cell phone. They actually did, so she's a little out of date here. But they said the phone was turned off. So it was pretty much immediately turned off. We will be going into that detail after I go over this. During that weekend, Alexis and Randy attempted to contact Brian to no avail. Concerned, Alexis went to his apartment, but while his car was parked in its spot and nothing looked out of place in his apartment, there was no sign of Brian. Brian wouldn't be reported as a missing person until that Monday, the day he and Alexis were to depart for Miami. Alexis arrived at the airport hoping that Brian might show up, explain his absence, and the couple would go on their romantic getaway and move on with their lives. Her hopes were short-lived. The investigation. Police began their search at the Ugly Tuna where Brian was last seen. Not only did the Ugly Tuna have security cameras installed, but other bars nearby had them, and officers examined the footage from these establishments as well, yet there was no trace of Brian. And by the way, there were no cameras inside the Ugly Tuna Saluna, just on the outside. Investigators knew it was possible that the cameras at the Ugly Tuna might have missed him, as one camera panned across the area while the other was operated manually. There was another exit not generally used by the public, a service door that at the time opened onto a construction site that officers believed would have been difficult to walk through while sober, much less intoxicated. And it's not really clear what difficult means. So is there just a bunch of stuff in the way? Or are there dangerous places where you can fall through and die? So they never really elaborated. It seems from what it sounds like, there's just a lot of stuff in the way, barricades, or just it's not easy to traverse. Not necessarily dangerous, but I don't know. The search continued to fan out from where Brian was last seen with law enforcement, sometimes accompanied by police dogs, searching dumpsters, sewers. They actually got special permission from the city to do extensive searching in the sewers. So this was not a lazy investigation by any means. And landfills, while flyers with Brian's picture and description were passed along. They also searched the river nearby. So they did a very, very thorough search. The flyers noted the distinctive fleck in one of his irises and showed the tattoo on his right arm of the stick figure logo from the cover art of Pearl Jam's single, Alive. After Randy Schaefer received a tip from a psychic stating that Brian's body would be found in a body of water, he and Derek, along with some other concerned citizens, spent many hours searching along the shores and near the bridges of the Olentangy River, which flows through Columbus adjacent to the OSU campus and is about 1 mile from Brian's apartment. Again, there were no traces of him to be found. Everyone who saw Brian the night of March 31st, morning of April 1st, was given a lie detector test, except for Clint Florence, who not only declined, but lawyered up as well. Actually, yeah. It's not necessarily suspicious that he retained a lawyer once the investigation began. Clint did provide police with everything he knew about that night. However, I do question why he wouldn't agree to take the polygraph. His lawyer actually recommended he not take it, I believe. So the police, he cooperated with the police, and at a certain point, the police kept, I guess, bothering him to a certain extent, to where he got a lawyer, because and his lawyer recommended that, you know, since allegedly he told them everything he knew, there was nothing to be gained. But who knows? The two women Brian had last seen talking to were later identified in 2009 and claimed that they had never been asked to take the test. That's kind of weird. It took them 3 years to identify. If this is accurate, it took them 3 years to identify the last two. That's kind of weird. Huh. Okay. Again, nothing in Brian's apartment was amiss. There were no signs of a struggle, nothing of value was missing, and his car was in its usual spot. There was no activity detected on his cell phone or bank accounts after he disappeared. Now, here's what's really weird. Every night for several months, Alexis called Brian's cell phone in the hopes that someday he might answer. While her calls usually went straight to voicemail, one night in September, his phone rang three times. In her excitement, Alexis called it several more times, and although it continued to ring, there was no answer. Brian's wireless carrier, Singular, said that this may have been caused by a computer glitch. As his phone was not GPS-enabled, the exact location could not be determined, but a ping was detected at a cell tower in Hilliard, 14 miles northwest of Columbus. As of this writing, Brian Schaefer, along with his cell phone and wallet, which were both on his person, have never been found. What do you guys think of that cell phone? Is that really a glitch? That seems kind of strange, because that glitch, I don't know. Do you buy that?
Was it a glitch, or was that number was given out and she was unaware of that?
I don't think so, because I'm assuming the family continued paying for the cell phone just in case. That's what they usually do. So the number wouldn't have been changed. The only thing I could think of is that if somebody stole his phone or picked it up and then they were messing with it that day and they had it on or charged or whatnot. So that's not necessarily, not if he was killed, not necessarily his killer, but if his phone was lost and somebody just found the phone and they were going to pawn it or whatever and they had it on. What do you think, Maxwell?
I don't know. I think... It was a good theory, what you just talked about. Like, you know, someone accident or someone tried to turn it on to try to mess with his phone or try to pawn it or whatever.
All right, so let me finish this article with theories. There are many theories that can be found online as to what may have happened to Brian Schaefer. Many feel that he never made it out of the Ugly Tuna, having met with foul play somewhere inside the bar. Others feel that he was a victim of the smiley face killer and met his end in the Olentangy River, or that he could have taken a walk by the river and accidentally fell in. As the service door of the bar was not equipped with security cameras, some believe that Brian may have exited through there and had trouble maneuvering his way through the construction site and fatally hurt himself, and fearing a lawsuit, the owners of the Ugly Tuna disposed of his body. You think that's likely? But real quick point about the smiley face killer. The missing men who go missing, they're near certain rivers. So Boston's a big one. But in the Olentangy, this has happened before. That's why the psychic, if they're not a real psychic, they guessed that that happened to him, because then they look credible. Because if there's a serial killer out there killing people, throwing them in rivers, and then the bodies wash up, that might have been a good guess. If this really was the work of the smiley face killer and the body was meant to wash up but somehow got caught in a boat or something somewhere, got caught by something somewhere somehow in the river and never surfaced and it's possibly still there, that's another possibility. What do you guys think about that?
It's a lot of somethings. And someone's and somewhere and somehow even that those are left out. So I'm going to go, I'm assuming they have a theory where he may have just joined the band.
Joined the band?
knows? If he had apparently a dream of joining a band, and especially after recently his mother recent passing, he may have assessed that life is too short and one's dreams must be lived. And
so do you mean he joined the band that was playing at the Ugly Tuna?
Yes.
So, but they were all interviewed by police and they gave him nothing. So they smuggled him out in the van because the band members said they didn't see them. And the staff of the Ugly Tuna said they didn't see him unless they all paid. He paid off all this. He slipped all the staff, like a couple hundreds, to say they didn't see him.
Could have, or they just could not have. May not pay attention as much as they may believe, as one might believe. I mean, he did wear, from the video I had seen, his outfit was relatively normal. Anyone could have worn that. He's to be mistaken or ignored even.
Maxwell, what do you think? Was that on one of your likely theories that he joined the band that was there and they smuggled him out? He must have been a really phenomenal musician if they'd go through all the trouble. I mean, how often would a band, if you're a band and you're playing at some place called the Ugly Tuna and some random person walks up to you and be like, hey, can I join the band? Yeah, sure. We'll smuggle you out in the van.
Yeah, I like the tripping and get fear of getting sued theory more.
You think they would go through that? Yeah, I mean, it's possible. I'm sure that has happened in other situations and it's never been found out. Is that what also happened in this situation? Yes, very, very possible. All right, let me finish this up. Since more than 11 years have gone by and his body and other personal belongings have never been found, I have a hard time accepting the theory that he was either thrown or fell into the river. Security cameras around the area showed no evidence that Brian had been walking around there, and as it is a high traffic area, someone should have seen him at some point. I also have difficulty accepting the idea that a business owner would take a chance on disposing of someone's dead body in order to avoid legal problems. Then again, I am willing to admit that nothing is completely impossible, but personally, it makes no sense to me. The neighborhood around South Campus Gateway was known at the time to be a high crime area. There is a slight possibility that Brian could have been attacked after exiting the bar, especially if he used the unmonitored exit that opened up to the construction site. I have read some speculation online that Clint was a drug user, although I don't know if there is any proof. If this is true, could Brian have been in the wrong place at the wrong time due to his association with Clint? Could he have witnessed something? Why hasn't Clint agreed to take a polygraph test? Does he know more about Brian's disappearance than he initially let on? Brian's loved ones seem to believe so. One theory that those who knew Brian tend to dismiss is that he either took his own life or disappeared on his own, choosing to start a whole new life somewhere else. Personally, I have my doubts about the suicide theory. As for running off and leaving everything behind, here's my input. Again, this is my opinion, so take it for what it's worth. Those closest to Brian never detected signs of depression. They claim that although he was grieving over the loss of his mother just weeks prior, he was handling it well. Something that should be noted was that shortly after Renee passed away, in a phone call to Alexis, Brian told her that he was having difficulty coping with everything and that she should move on and find someone new. Not long after that conversation, Brian took back his words and asked her to go away with him. While out for their steak dinner, Randy noticed that Brian looked particularly exhausted that evening, which was to be expected given the workload at school leading up to spring break, coupled with the loss of Renee. Randy also had a strong feeling that Brian shouldn't go out with Clint that night, but kept this to himself. Did Randy have some sort of premonition that something was seriously wrong with his son, or that he was in danger? While many feel that Brian would never have left behind his family, whom he was very close with, or his promising career as a doctor, or his loving and beautiful girlfriend, whom he planned to marry, haven't stranger things happened? Do we truly know what's going on in the minds and hearts of those closest to us? Anyone who knows me personally or has read my memoir knows that I spent my first 25 years living a life that I hated, all to please my family. Now, I'm not saying this was the case with Brian Schaefer. I've never met Brian or his family. The point I'm trying to make is this. People that thought they knew me during those years I was pretending to be someone else I wasn't really don't know me at all. Then one day, after one too many incidents took place within my personal life to create the perfect storm, I walked out on everything and began to create a life of my own, one that I wanted to live, not one that I was living simply to make everyone else happy. My taking this drastic step deeply shocked those that supposedly closest to me, including my own parents. No one knew how unhappy I was until that point. Why? Because no one took the time to ask if I was happy, and as a general rule, the average person only looks at the surface or simply sees what they want to see. Again, I am not saying that on April 1st, that's a good day to go missing. What do you think about that, guys? So this was on April 1st. If he did pull some kind of prank to go and start a new life, would that be the day to do it?
What do you mean prank? What do you mean?
April 1st is April Fool's Day.
Oh, wait, that's when he went missing?
Yeah, that's what I just said.
Oh, shit.
Max Larmy.
I didn't know that.
It's a good thing you got all the facts of the case, Maxwell. No input on that? The only thing you could say is I didn't know that?
I don't know. It's a long April Fool's Day joke.
Well, no, not what if it wasn't exactly a joke or prank? He wanted to go and start a new life, so he just did it on April 1st. Like, it's not like a gag. Like, it's not like he's going to return to his life. That wasn't the gag. The gag was just a disappearance. Sid, what do you think about that? Yes.
I'm sorry, what's your specific theory?
Sid's pulling a Maxwell.
I forgot to
He went missing on April 1st, so I was just saying that's an interesting day to go missing.
That's April Fool's joke, a very elaborate one indeed.
Maxwell was saying that's a pretty long April Fool's joke, but what if the joke wasn't to go back to his life? What if the whole point of the so-called prank was to disappear and not return? So it's not like it was something that he would have to keep up. It's just something that he did, disappeared, now he's got a new life, boom, done, and he just happened to do it on April 1st.
That theory I can go along with. So I have to question at what moment exactly. It's obviously beforehand when he decided that I need a change in life. I mean, it's a rather elaborate decision to disappear just like that. It makes you wonder if he had picked the tuna, that place himself personally, so it'd be such a big mystery.
Yeah, we're going to go over the security footage in a minute, but let me just round this out. So, again, I'm not saying that on April 1st, 2006, Brian Schaefer decided to chuck it all and take off to a remote island with nothing but the clothes on his back, his phone, and wallet, and decide to start that Jimmy Buffett-inspired band he always dreamed of, leaving behind his loved ones. The reason I'm bringing all this up is because, in so much that I've read and listened to online, many people disregard that theory due to the fact that Brian seemed relatively happy, and he was making plans for his future, and it just didn't seem at all like him. Is it difficult in this day and age to completely vanish on your own and fly under the grid without being detected at some point? Sure. Absolutely impossible? I don't believe so. One argument against this theory is that there has been no activity on Brian's bank account since he vanished. So, in order to do this, he would have had to use cash, and he never carried cash with him. Who's to say he didn't have any with him that night? I'm a very firm believer that each and every one of us has multiple sides to our beings, and some of those sides are hidden from others, even those that believe they know us best. Randy Schaefer. Tragically, Randy Schaefer will never have the chance to discover what happened to his oldest son. In September 2008, a heavy windstorm hit central Ohio, and while in his yard, a branch blew off from a nearby tree, fatally striking Randy. Neighbors would find his body the next morning. In the condolences guestbook section of his online obituary, a signature was entered reading, "To Dad, Love, Brian, parentheses, U.S. Virgin Islands." An investigation took place that found the post was made from a public computer in Franklin County, Ohio, and was determined to be a cruel hoax. That's messed up.
Indeed.
I cannot begin to imagine what Brian's brother Derek must be going through, having lost both his parents and his older brother in such a short amount of time. I and many others can only hope that he eventually finds answers to the many questions that I'm sure have been tormenting him for years. If there is anyone out there that knows something, I truly hope and pray they find the courage to come forward. So the missing poster says Brian Schaefer missing April 1st, 2006. Brian Schaefer, an OSU medical student who was last seen at the Ugly Tuna Saluna near the OSU campus April 1st, 27 years old, 6 foot two, 160 to 165 pounds, tattoo on his upper right arm, Pearl Jam symbol. And also what's interesting, obviously in hindsight, this all looks slightly bizarre, but so his favorite song is Pearl Jam Alive. And if he is pulling a prank on April 1st, that's kind of interesting. So I'm just going to go over the lyrics of the song real quick. Son, she said, have I got a little story for you? What you thought was your daddy was nothing. But a while you were sitting home alone at age 13, your real daddy was dying. Sorry you didn't see him, but I'm glad we talked. I'm still alive. I'm still alive. I'm still alive. Yeah, oh. While she walked slowly across a young man's room, she said, I'm ready for you. I can't remember anything to this very day, except the look, oh, you know where. Now I can't see, I just stare. I'm still alive. Yeah, yeah, okay, I'm still alive. Is something wrong? She said, of course there is. You're still alive, she said. Oh, do I deserve to be? Is that the question? And if so, who answers? Who answers? And then he goes over the chorus again. So again, in hindsight, it's kind of weird, but if he had never gone missing, none of this would be weird, right?
Yeah.
So what are your theories? So Sid, you're going with the band smuggled him out of there and he just joined their band. And that's it. Nobody ever saw him again. And if he did perform, nobody ever saw him performing and reported that?
There is that potential chance. If not, something going with the band and then smuggled out, then decide to, who knows, forge his own band. Or, as I said before, live his life in a completely different fashion.
I would say the only way that'd be possible, I mean, we're talking, I mean, it's not like, if this was like the 70s, 80s, maybe even early 90s, before the digital age really took off, it'd be possible, but he went missing 2006. I mean, we're talking post-internet age. I think he would have to be out of the country for him to be able to lie low enough, regardless of whether he was in a band or not. He would have to be lying low in some other country, I would guess. I mean, I don't know. I'm sure there's people. There are cases where people simply start a new identity in their own country. And I think there was even one case where it wasn't even that far from where they had disappeared from. It was maybe like one or two states over. It wasn't across the whole country. But yeah, I guess it's a theoretical possibility. That's your number one possibility, Sid?
No, my number one possibility. You said there was construction going on next door, correct?
Yes. That one of the doors opened to a construction site that was supposedly very difficult to navigate.
Yes. They listed kind of specifics to the construction, like were they laying down in concrete or anything like that?
So yes, one of the theories, if he slipped or fell and got covered somehow, the problem is they searched it with dogs. So I don't think there was any concrete poured the next day. So they did, or even in a couple days later, I think a couple weeks later, they might have poured the concrete floor weeks later, if not a month or two later, whatever it was, because there was construction. So that's a possibility, but not, there's nothing been reported that anything got poured within 2-3 days of him going missing. So they searched it with dogs. I mean, obviously dogs aren't perfect, but apparently there were multiple searches. People, dogs. I mean, if they're calling his phone, so what's weird is his phone was turned off. We're going to go through the exact timeline here in a minute, but first I just wanted to get your general impressions. Maxwell, what do you got? What do you think? You think they were just covered? So there was a fatal accident. They got rid of his body that night and covered it up so nobody would ever know, fearing a lawsuit?
Yeah, that's more practical or realistic, I think.
Still, though. I must admit, though, they did search with dogs, depending. No weather was clear that night, right? The day after?
I'm not sure I've seen the weather report. I'm guessing, because they would have probably mentioned that. Are you saying I mean, dogs would, the weather, I mean, yes, that can impair dogs, but I mean, that we're talking, oh, like, if they used scent dogs, and then I'm sure they've used cadaver dogs as well. So the cadaver dogs, that wouldn't really put them off. I don't know about even the scent dogs. If he was there, if he was several feet away, I'm not sure any weather would prevent them from finding him. It's not like he's buried, or, I mean, do you think so? Do you think somebody could have harmed him and then buried him somewhere in the construction site, and just put like some concrete blocks or something over him, and then a whole bunch of rain or whatever happened? Do you think in that type of scenario would the dogs miss him? I guess it's theoretically possible they might have, but that would mean that somebody intentionally hit him, because if he just fell. If it was just an accident and he fell, how would he get covered so severely as to not be found by dogs? All right, let me go over one other write-up. This is from reallifeishorror.blogspot.com. They have some really, really interesting articles. What really happened to Brian Schaefer? This was posted December 29th, 2018, so pretty recently. Brian Schaefer was just 27-year-old. Well, one more thing. So he's 27, and he's 6'2". So this is not a tiny, small guy, and he's also not like 18, 19, 20. He's not a young, dumb kid necessarily. I think that adds a little bit of a dynamic to this case, because some of these, like some random drunk college student who's 18, 19, 20, 21, 22, they're, I mean, you know, not to be cliche, but generally college kids those age are not exactly the most street smart or smart in general. So they're more likely to get into bad situations with bad people. This guy's 27, really smart guy, 6'2". I think we have to consider that variable to not just write off, oh, he just got drunk and stumbled, died, or got attacked. I mean, yes, that might have happened. But we just have to keep in mind he's almost 30 years old.
Very true.
Okay, so Brian Schaefer was just 27 years old when he vanished off the face of the earth during spring break in 2006. Schaefer, who was a second-year medical student at Ohio State University, went missing after a night of bar hopping with friends on Friday, March 31st, 2006. And then into the early hours would be April 1st. Before hitting the town with friends that night, Brian went out to dinner with his dad and brother to celebrate. His father did not notice anything off about his son other than the fact that he seemed fatigued, which he thought was probably due to one too many nights of late studying for exams. Around 9:50 p.m., he made a call to his girlfriend. She had no idea it would be the last time she heard his voice. After the meal at around 10 p.m., Brian met with a friend named William Clint Forrest. The two met at a local bar named the Ugly Tuna Saluna. So it doesn't state here who suggested they meet there, but it seems like it was a popular spot. So it might just be the usual spot, and neither one of them necessarily was like, oh yeah, we have to go here, if that was just the normal spot. The bar was on 1546 North High Street in Columbus. But Google it these days and you'll notice it's recorded as being permanently closed. It wasn't closed until years later, so it's not like they closed it right after this, which would be more suspicious if they were trying to cover something up. The Ugly Tuna Saluna had an average rating of 2 out of 5 stars on Yelp. They have one of, if not the best happy hours on campus, being $1 any well drink from 8 to 10 Monday through Saturday, says one customer. How can you hate a place that sells jello shots in a big plastic syringe and puts a plastic alligator in your huge fishbowl of alcohol? Another user writes. From there, Brian and Clint visited multiple bars throughout the course of the evening, slamming a shot at each establishment with the aim of ending up at Arena District. The Arena District is a neighborhood in Columbus that is easy to walk on foot. It has everything from bars to restaurants to malls and sports facilities. All right, here's another point, though. Since they went to a couple different bars, is it possible that a serial killer spotted him at one of the bars and followed him? Maxwell, Sid, no thoughts on that?
Say that again.
They went to multiple bars, so is it possible that a serial killer spotted him at one of the other bars and followed him to the Ugly Tuna? Because I know the police had interviewed pretty much everybody they could find that was there that night at the Ugly Tuna. But, and if there was nobody suspicious, what if it was a serial killer? Because the entrance to the Ugly Tuna, as you guys can see in the security cam, it's like an escalator that goes up. There's an entrance on the second floor. There are other establishments in the area. So if there was a serial killer following him, he wouldn't necessarily had to have even gone inside the Ugly Tuna. He could have followed Brian, or maybe he was following somebody else and he saw Brian. Who knows? But he didn't necessarily have to go in the Ugly Tuna. He could have been watching from a distance. And then he could have, if Brian went out a different way. We're going to examine Brian's actions in the security footage in a moment. But I just wanted to point out, what if, because there's no way the police could have interviewed every single person at every single bar that they had hopped that night. Maybe they found a couple people, but yeah, if there was some random guy, what do you guys think?
I like that theory. I think it's possible that the serial killer like went into that alley or that path towards the construction area. And whoever walks in there, he kills. Because no one will ever find out because he's going to, you know, because there's no cameras there on the way up.
Yeah. Sid, what do you think?
Potentially, it's a rather solid theory to go with. And I would have to wonder whether or not they had known about this bar and knew about the limited viewpoints that were under surveillance at the time make any use. But as you said, with the dogs, they had to say they were disposed of his body, let's say at the construction site that the cadaver dogs went through, and to have those sent up would be interesting.
Well, if it was an experienced serial killer, let's say he's got some kind of van, and he would know, he could have staked out, particularly if he had killed anybody else in that area or at other bars, he would have staked it out so he would know where all the security cameras are, so he could have parked somewhere. Or it's a half-mile walk from the Ugly Tuna to Brian's apartment, so anywhere along that walk, he could have knocked him over the head and pulled him into a van, right? If he knew the exact spots and he had the place staked out, or he could have done it in the construction site, knocked him out, carried him to a vehicle that was not on camera. Obviously, this is all a little tough because there is a bar crowd, especially when the bar closes, all the people, there's a big crowd leaving. So he would have had to do all this without anybody in the crowd seeing him. And I'm guessing, I don't know exactly how the band leaves, but if the band's packing up their equipment and everything, they don't generally go through the front entrance. Bands always go through back entrances for the most part. So the band would have seen the serial killer, unless the band is a band of serial killers. If they were the only ones in the back, but yeah, that would be insane.
True. Or, I mean, it could have happened long before the band would have gone to the back. They might have still been on stage during that time frame.
Brian and Clint reached their destination at around midnight after stopping at various bars along the way. They hitched a ride back with a female friend of Clint named Meredith Reed. The three drove back to the Ugly Tuna and had one last drink together. Surveillance footage from the bar confirms that the three did indeed go back into the tuna, and they were recorded arriving at 1:15 a.m. So what did you guys make of the actual surveillance video?
Personally, for me, wait, now that I think about it, they had shown him going in with his friends, correct?
Yeah, and later. Here's the thing that this is what I take from it. The three of them seemed relatively relaxed and in good spirits going up the escalator. But later in the last known footage where Brian is talking to the two girls, it seems like he's kind of agitated. And his body language seems completely different than when he was going up on the escalator earlier.
Indeed, I agree. Though I found it interestingly strange that, you know, Trent even be there talking to these two females that I'm assuming are particularly friends of his that he's aware of.
Yeah, supposedly he had just met them that night. Yeah.
And I mean, I'm not saying people can't be social and, you know, make quick connections, but, you know, mainly for a man who is, as is shown with him having multiple videos, even that last message he sent to his girlfriend, that, you know, he had intentions to propose to her. And
well, he didn't say that. Other people said that he was going to. Yeah.
Well, for him to give off such a strong impression, it would just be odd for him to even talk to other females just like that by himself. You think, you know, he probably
according to Clint, Brian regularly did that.
Right there, as much as people might say, you know, he is in love with his girlfriend, and again, quote unquote, but supposedly they felt that he probably would have proposed on that said trip. It's a contradictory action to be taking.
Maybe. Maxwell, what do you think?
Are you leading to the point where, like, there were some jealous boyfriends from those two girls or something? Or, like...
Nobody was talking about that, but if you want to bring that up, you can bring that up. We didn't talk about that.
That's a good theory, too, where he was hitting up on those two girls. Maybe, he didn't drink, right?
He did. Or, he was drunk.
Oh, he did? Maybe, like, he started making out with one
did
of
you
the
miss,
girls.
Did you miss the whole thing where they were bar hopping and doing shots at every bar?
Oh, okay. So, I don't know. I'm thinking he made out with those two girls and the boyfriend got jealous and then killed them.
So, crime of passion.
You think he made out with those two girls in front of everybody at a bar frequented by medical students and people on the campus, people that would know his girlfriend? Like, you... I'm not saying he wouldn't have done that, but they would have reported that if that's what happened.
I don't know. Maybe he went to some corner and the boyfriend like followed the girl and then killed him in that corner of the.
So in your know. So okay, so obviously those girls should have taken a lie detector test or the new brain fingerprint scanning technology. Obviously, the old lie detector test not really accurate, but the brain fingerprint scan is pretty legit. Obviously, they should take it because if they were lying, the police cleared them. So the police did not feel like they were lying in any way. So they probably just said Brian talked to him for a little bit. But anyway, continuing on, at some point, Clint noticed that Brian was missing. Despite their repeated attempts to call and locate him, he was nowhere to be found. Clint and Meredith were eventually ushered out of the bar at closing time around 2 a.m. Although they continued to wait for their missing friend outside of the bar, he never showed up. They did tell police that Brian went to talk to the live band after they finished their set that night, but the members of the band couldn't offer up any helpful information. Brian had two sides to him. On one hand, he had been training his whole life to become a doctor, and on the other hand, he wanted nothing more than to be a musician and songwriter. He was a fan of Eddie Vedder and Jimmy Buffett and had a tattoo of the artwork from the Pearl Jam single Alive. Eventually, Brian's friends assumed that he had returned to his apartment in King Avenue without telling them and gave up looking. King Avenue is around 1 hour 40 minutes on foot, but only a 10 to 12 minute drive by car. Wait, what? That does not seem accurate. Yeah, no, it's only a half a mile. It's 10. This guy must have had it wrong. Yeah, it's only about a 10 minute walk, half a mile. Depending on which route you take, but yeah, it's only a couple blocks. Did Brian hail a cab after failing to find his friends, or did someone offer him a ride home? One could reach King Avenue by car via Olentangy River Road, which runs parallel to the river itself. Schaefer had an important flight to Miami, Florida to catch the following Monday, but after he failed to show up for it, he was quickly reported missing. CCTV footage from outside of the Ugly Tuna revealed that Brian Schaefer was last spotted chatting with two women outside of the bar at 1:55 a.m. before bidding them goodnight and appearing to walk backwards towards the Ugly Tuna entrance. This footage would go on to inspire a theory about what happened to Brian that night. How could it be that the man was recorded seemingly entering a building but not leaving? First of all, the cameras did not exactly record him going into the bar, only in the direction of. Now, this is a very good point. Many people assume that he was heading back into the Ugly Tuna as his friends were still inside and the bar was not yet closed. Also, none of the surveillance footage handed into police that night captured Brian in the local area. See, that's another thing that's really, really weird. Because would Brian, if he's going away, starting a new life, they went through all of the security footage cams in that whole area. I don't know how many block radius they went through, but from what it sounds like, this was a very thorough investigation, a thorough search. He doesn't show up on any of the CCTV cameras of any of the businesses surrounding the area. So how is that possible? So it seems like if a serial killer put him in his vehicle, or someone offered him a ride coincidentally outside of the view of cameras, if it was a serial killer, then that staked out the cameras, that's almost slightly more likely, because then the serial killer would know where the cameras were. Does that make you guys think that he's still in the building or in the construction site somewhere because the CCTV cameras in the area never picked him up? Every time I ask a question, there's like a long 30-second pause. Or long.
I was just deliberating. That's all that is. Pondering. Working the theories out of my mind. It's a process.
It is strange that he wasn't. To me, it's very. I don't find it likely that Brian would have scouted out all of the security cameras. So if he's going to disappear, I mean, maybe, but that's more likely the MO of a serial killer.
And it would be, though. Again, like I said, Ryan would just have to be the very unlucky target. And he would have, because he would have had to have gotten in place, I imagine, for quite some time, if. Not, let's just say, weeks or months, if it's a experienced serial killer, I imagine at least a few days, just to make sure.
Maxwell, what do you think? What is the lack of Brian showing up at any of the surrounding establishments' CCTV cameras tell you?
Well, I was thinking about what you said, like, Brian, like, going around looking at the CCTV cameras and try to avoid it. I just don't see the point of that. So
that makes you think it's the construction site accident and a cover up to avoid a lawsuit?
Or the cheating boyfriend thing, or the cheating girlfriend, I don't know what I mean.
So you believe he never left the bar or construction area?
I don't believe anything. I'm just kind of theorizing. I mean,
yeah.
You know.
So if he never left the bar, are you assuming that someone may have killed him and stuffed him into a wall?
And what?
So, I mean, if you say you never left the bar, is there a potential assumption that somebody killed him and then stuffed him into said wall of the bar somewhere?
Yeah, or... I mean, we're actually going to go back to that, because there were some rumors from the Ugly Tuna staff that were very interesting. But let me finish with Real Life is Horror Blogspot. There was reportedly a service door which was off limits to general patrons. Brian's lack of authority to exit the building through a staff-only door would not only make it physically impossible for him to do so, which is why many an internet sleuth hypothesizes that taking another exit is exactly what he did. The emergency exit door. The only problem with this theory is that the service door led out onto a construction site, and Brian was not captured on any other surveillance tape in the local area. The local area was plentiful with other bars and restaurants that handed in their CCTV tapes from that night, but there was no sign of Brian on any of them. He had not returned to his apartment that night, and his car was still parked outside. His apartment was targeted by robbers a month later. That's kind of interesting, right? So his apartment was robbed, but apparently not much was taken. Huh. Does that mean anything to you guys?
But he was robbed?
Yeah, a month later, his apartment was burglarized.
Weird.
So if it was burglarized, what's interesting is I don't have all the exact details, but supposedly none of his clothes or personal effects were taken. So I don't know if they managed to take some cash or something or some valuable items, but apparently none of his personal effects, which someone would need, like even his glasses, like he wore glasses, his glasses were still at his apartment. So some people think that if he broke, he wanted to make it look like someone broke into his apartment so he could take some stuff. And they would think it wasn't him if he was starting a new life. But apparently his personal effects were not taken. So then it wouldn't have been him. It really probably was a random robber.
Which would make sense. I could see that. Especially if it's known that he disappeared.
Yeah.
So. You know, clearly in their mindset, if they're someone looking for anything or needing some way to make some cash, I mean, better than a rob than a person that's gone just missing. Because at that point, I guess they're just assuming, well, he doesn't need it.
That's messed up.
too, but
Maxwell, what do you think?
I figured he had some kind of like secret USB info or something for.
Oh, you think he was kind of secret agent involved in something, and the government orchestrated his disappearance, and rival spy agencies were breaking into his apartment looking for the secret drive.
Yeah, they couldn't find it on his person. So
let me do this one. That would make a good movie. Okay, but it was a month later, though. That's the only thing that doesn't make sense, because if it was some kind of secret spy hit or abduction related to spy agencies and secret spies, wouldn't they have gone to his apartment that same night?
Probably not. I don't know. It's not too obvious. Or, you know, they needed a vacation from killing him. And then go back to his apartment to look for it.
Police did at one point entertain the idea that he could have changed clothes with the intention of voluntarily walking away from his life. However, it is not known if that was the case. That is kind of interesting, though, because if he did have a change of clothes, or what if Brian Schaefer accidentally or got into a fight, not kill the guy, but the guy never came forward, like he just knocked him out or something, or just roughed him up? And then he took the guy's shirt because he didn't want people looking for him. And then something else happened. Because if he pulled down like a baseball hat over his face and put on a different shirt and jacket, the police might miss him, right? I mean, I don't know. They're specifically looking for him. So, yeah, I don't know. Like I said, that was one of their theories too, because if he had changed clothes, they might have not spotted him. His family argues that his life was good and that he had a bright future ahead of him. He was going to be a doctor and was apparently planning on proposing to his girlfriend, Alexis Wagoner, also a medical student, in Miami on a spring break vacation that he had spent weeks planning to perfection. So that's in quotes. So someone reported that he had spent weeks planning to perfection this spring break vacation to Miami. In a TV show about the case, Brian's girlfriend reveals the content of their last phone call on the night that he went missing. Brian apparently told her, in regards to going out that Friday night, "This is my chance to talk about you with the guys. I love you, and I'll see you in a couple of days." Police did an extensive search along with a canine unit, but nothing turned up. They walked the Olentangy River, searched the sewers, and even looked through the dumpsters in the area. Eddie Vedder also pitched in on the hunt to find the missing med student and read out loud a description of him while holding up the missing flyer at a Pearl Jam show not long after Brian went missing. So, once again, the missing persons poster says, date of birth, February 11th, 1979, 28 years old. 28 years old? Oh, so I guess this was a year after. Height 6'2", weight 160 to 165, eyes hazel, tattoo, upper right arm, Pearl Jam symbol, Central Ohio, Crime Stoppers. Okay, it was widely circulated, but other than a homeless man who thought he saw Brian a week after his initial disappearance, nothing came of it. Huh. That's interesting. Now, how often do homeless people spot missing persons? I'm guessing they probably, if there's a big reward, would they say they saw him? And then if they happen to find him, they would have to give the homeless person a reward, right? So it's almost like a luck of the draw. I mean, how often do homeless people do that? I don't know. What do you guys think?
How often would a homeless person do what?
Say they saw a missing person, even if they didn't, just to try to get a reward. Because what if they're found in the area where the homeless person said they saw them? Then the homeless person would get the reward, right? Because they gave them the info that it was around this area.
Yeah, and usually the homeless person has no information of the reward because they're so isolated.
What are you talking about? They'd see the posters all over every single like telephone pole and on every single building in businesses. Like the area was, there's missing posters with the reward right on it everywhere. So the homeless person, you missed the whole point, Maxwell. The homeless person would know exactly what the reward was because they would have seen the poster. So they could have made up the story that they saw him.
I see. I don't know. I'm thinking internet-wise for some reason. I don't know.
Sid, what do you think? Homeless person's account was legit or not when he said he saw Brian? This is a week later. Sid, are you still pondering or did you miss the question?
Oh.
A homeless person said he saw Brian Schaefer.
Or should I just see somebody look like Brian?
Maybe. Yeah, maybe. So they also looked, they searched hospitals, homeless shelters. They, they went, apparently they, they really did, they did an extensive search. So the homeless guy apparently saw him in, in Columbus. So, he was wearing jeans and a striped shirt. So this was actually reported, there was a news report April 10th. Columbus, Ohio detectives said they were investigating a tip that a missing Ohio State University medical student was seen at a North Columbus convenience store almost 4 days after he disappeared. Police said the tip came from a homeless man, and they believe the tip could be credible. NBC4's Duarte Geraldino reported. Brian Schaefer was last seen in front of the Ugly Tuna Saloon on North High Street in the South Campus Gateway area early on April 2nd. Why are they saying April 2nd? After midnight, that would have been April 1st, right? According to police, the tipster said that Schaefer was behind a United Dairy Farmers store located at High Street and 12th Avenue. The individual indicated that the man that he had seen was eating a sandwich, said Columbus Police Detective John Hurst. He believes it was bought from one of the local restaurants. Detectives said the homeless man attempted to talk with the man he believed was Schaefer, but the person walked off into the alley. The homeless man said that he said, "Hey, people are looking for you," and the individual really didn't have much of a reaction, Hurst said. Schaefer's mother died shortly before he disappeared, Geraldino reported. His father, Randy Schaefer, believes that stress might have been too much for the second-year medical student. "It hasn't been totally checked out yet, but I am going with that positive thought," Randy Schaefer said. "It lifts me up a little bit." Detectives said that they were working to obtain surveillance footage from the UDF store. They hope that if a tipster saw Brian Schaefer, that the cameras did too. Clint Florence is the last person to see Brian Schaefer. The two used to live together and were out celebrating the beginning of spring break. Florence described Schaefer as a popular but a bit of a loner. Brian likes to either see somebody that he knows or wants to talk to the band. He is known to walk off. He just liked to walk off and do his own thing, Florence said. Florence described the timeline of the night Brian Schaefer disappeared. The men headed to the Ugly Tuna at about 9:15 p.m. At about 10:30 p.m., Brian Schaefer spoke to his girlfriend over the phone, Florence said. About 30 minutes later, the men walked to the Short North Tavern, where they had a few drinks. At 11:40, they walked to another bar. Then, at about 1:15, they returned to the Ugly Tuna. Florence said that while he was drinking, Brian Schaefer periodically walked away to talk with some people he knew. Brian got up with them. I am assuming he got up with them, walked out with them to talk with them on the foyer before going on the escalator, Florence said. Schaefer was last seen on surveillance cameras at about 2 a.m. I called him that night, and it went straight to voicemail. It was about 2 a.m., and there was no answer, Florence said. So within minutes of being seen on the surveillance camera, his phone is off. Does that strike you as weird, guys? Unless his phone died. I mean, it's kind of, I guess his phone could have died. That's a pretty long day, 2 a.m. if he charged it overnight. Especially in 2006, some of the phones weren't great with battery life. Then again, if he didn't use his phone that often during the day, maybe it didn't die. I don't know. Nobody else's phone there died. So, but it was going straight to voicemail, which is interesting, right? Within minutes of the last time he was last seen, it's going to voicemail.
That could mean that he was already in trouble.
If he fell, here's the thing though. If he fell at the construction site and got fatally injured, why was his phone be off? Unless his phone got shattered in the accident. Yeah. If his phone broke in the accident, maybe. I'm afraid that Brian might have left the bar and ran his mouth a little bit. He has been known to do that, Florence said. Now, if you're talking about your friend, would you say something like that, Maxwell? If your friend goes missing, would you say he has been known to run his mouth? He might have left the bar. Why would he say that? I'm afraid that Brian might have left the bar and ran his mouth a little bit. He has been known to do that.
Ran his mouth like to complain and... weird.
I don't know. It doesn't say. At closing time, after looking for Schaefer, Florence said he went home with another friend. Of course, I regret now leaving, but I didn't think anything of it. I didn't think, Brian, that anything happened to him because he is known to walk away, Florence said. Police said none of Schaefer's bank account or credit cards have been used since he disappeared. That's pretty weird. I wonder whatever happened with the surveillance camera at the convenience store. I'm assuming it wasn't him because I'm sure they checked it. Or they couldn't tell, or there was no angle of, yeah. Unless there was no angle of it.
Yeah, I don't know. Were there any, like, later, like, recent developments or no?
Just a couple details that have been released here and there. I'm going to go over them. So, to finish up with the Real Life is Horror Blogspot post, Brian's family called his cell phone repeatedly and heartbreakingly every day for the next several months after he went missing. The calls went directly to his voicemail. Strangely, on the 23rd of September, when Brian's girlfriend called his phone, just as she did routinely each night, it rang. It rang several more times, each time going to voicemail when it wasn't answered. Either the phone was turned on after several months, or it was a temporary malfunction on the provider's end. How could that be a malfunction, though? I really want to see the statistics on how often a malfunction occurs when a phone is dead, that it just rings a bunch of times and then goes to voicemail. I don't know. Everyone who met with Brian that night, including his own father, took and passed the polygraph test. Everyone except Clinton, who refuses to do so and lawyered up, and the two women who he talked to that night at 1:55 a.m. Although the women were identified, they were never asked to sit a lie detector test, as investigators likely did not consider them suspects in Brian's disappearance. In an interview, Brian's brother talked of how Clint spoke of his brother in a negative light after he went missing. This, coupled with his resistance to taking a polygraph, made people suspicious of his involvement. Yeah, that is really weird. Why would you talk about someone who's supposedly your friend in a negative light if they went missing? Even if they didn't go missing, that's, you know, that's not being a good friend. But if they go missing, I mean, even a crummy friend probably wouldn't talk negatively about someone who went missing, right?
Yeah, that is kind of weird.
Yeah, that is really weird. Sid, what do you think about that? So apparently Brian's brother said that Clint spoke negatively about Brian after he went missing. So I was just asking Maxwell, even if you're a crummy friend, are you really going to talk about someone in a negative light that went missing?
I would imagine there had to be some serious problems and issues between the two before, so that were heavily, I guess, established or made publicly aware to everybody, to be clear that, you know, that there was an issue between the two, which I find that difficult to believe. So I can't strictly, unless you try, are you trying to suggest that this might have been a crime of passion, I guess, in the moment?
It seems weird. There's a couple, I'm going to get into a couple different theories regarding Mr. Clint here, because something just seems off about this Clint character. Now, whether it seems off because Clint is a drug user and possibly a drug dealer, and he's just a weird guy, he has nothing to do with Brian Schaefer going missing, but that could explain those actions. But it's just, he's just weird. Something seems off about it.
Is it because he ceases to be in Eastwood?
What was that?
Is it because he ceases to be in Eastwood?
He ceases to be a what?
Eastwood.
What?
An Eastwood.
An Eastwood?
Yes.
What does that mean?
Might have used a little bit of laughter from it, such as Clint Eastwood.
Oh, I didn't get that. I didn't get that. Maxwell, did you get that?
No, I missed it. What did you say?
Maxwell Army.
That's fine.
I was saying something about Clint seems off, and and Sid said that might be because he might be an Eastwood, like as in Clint Eastwood.
Oh, that's funny.
Yeah, I missed that when he first said that. But all right, let's go over, before we get to Clint, let's go over the fatal accident theory again. So some of these online sleuths, I'll go over some of the theories posted. The construction sites, I believe, are the answer. I think he stumbled into one of the construction sites, fell, and died. Then the companies involved covered it up for liability concerns. With all of those businesses on site, multiple construction sites, and a trash grinder, there's a good chance for an accident. If it was the construction sites, there was a cover-up most likely. If it was the trash grinder, it's possible no one ever realized before the remains were dumped with other trash. Okay, let's go with the CCTV footage. So someone posted this comment about the footage at 1:50 a.m. where he's talking to two girls. Who were they? When I first heard about this case and reviewed this footage, I instantly had a theory, a gut feeling, if you will. Seeing as Brian is talking to them outside, we can assume that he was spending time with them at the bar. I had an idea that these girls were possibly seeing other men who were inside the bar at the time, or another man or men had their eye on them and got angry and jealous at Brian. Maxwell, was that your theory?
What's that?
What I just said.
That he fell and died.
No, that was like 2 minutes ago. What I just said was that someone, the girls he was talking to, if some other men had their eye on those girls and got jealous and angry at Brian, a good-looking, smart young man, for talking to them.
Oh, yeah, that's one of the theories. I like that one.
Yeah. However, after studying the body language in the brief seconds we see, granted it's not much to go on, I get the impression they're not bothered about him. You can see them talking and arguing with each other as Brian is next to them. But not at one point do they look at him. Do they walk off? Maybe it's nothing. They're just out of shot. Also, is there anything in the girl who comes up the escalator alone? Where is she going as she's not going towards the bar? After Googling it, the entrance of the construction site is behind the camera on the left, as we see it from the camera angle, and there are two more doors on the right side, possibly toilets, as well as one door directly in line with the camera. There also appears to be an ATM to the right of it. Anyway, when she walks by, one man in the middle apparently points at her, an attractive girl. Then his mate seems to stare as well. This mate either says something to Brian or says something that gets Brian's attention because they quickly look at each other. What I find weird is that it's exactly when Brian walks off and the last time he's seen on CCTV. Personally, I think that could be crucial in solving this case. But what happens after that situation, I do not know. It's just a vague theory I had. I wonder if there were any altercations of note that night or a fracas. Something that happened in the bar or construction site and somebody knows. Okay, so going back to the footage, the girls are arguing with each other. They're like grabbing each other. It looks weird. And Brian seems agitated as well. So the thing that comes to mind first, now this isn't based on anything, but if Clint and Brian are drug dealers and he's trying to sell them drugs, but then one of the girls wants the drugs, one of them doesn't, would that cause a reaction like that? And then he seems frustrated at the whole scenario. Because let's say he's trying to, if he's just flirting with the girls or whatever, why would the girls be arguing with each other? If he's trying to pick either one or both of them up, why would that look like that? It seems like there's something else going on. What do you guys think about that?
Yeah, but I'm thinking maybe they were arguing about, maybe they're arguing about boyfriends or something. And then for some reason he got involved somehow.
His body language just really seems off to me. In those seconds, just the way he's standing, his posture, it's like, it just seems unusual. It seems like almost like if he's trying to sell them drugs and they don't want it or something weird like that. It doesn't seem like he would have that kind of body language just by flirting with them or just shooting the breeze about random things, unless he really does know the girls from before. So Clint almost gave a hint that he would, not necessarily people, he would go off to talk to people he knows a lot or just people he wanted to talk to. So that doesn't help us a lot. And Clint, I wonder if Clint told the police if he really didn't. It's so hard to tell because if people he knew were involved in his death, like Clint or some of these other people, or these other people know somebody who might have been involved, would they say if they were all also involved in buying and selling drugs or even just buying drugs, would you offer that to the police? Like if you're being interviewed about a missing person, would you say, oh yeah, he was trying to sell us drugs? Would you say that?
If you
never bought drugs before, maybe you would say that. But if you regularly buy drugs,
that's it. That's what I was thinking.
you wouldn't say that. Sid, what do you think about that? What could account for that body language? Because like I was telling Maxwell, it almost looks like he's trying to sell them drugs. One of them wants the drugs, one of them doesn't. So they're arguing with each other, and then his body language looks the way it is. But it doesn't look like normal body language for just flirting or having a shooting the breeze type conversation.
Didn't seem like it.
What do you think could account for that?
maybe kind of like one kind of flirting, and one may have conveyed an early interest while the other is rejecting it, and that could have irritated, agitated him. Or, as you just suggested, he might have, that's what I would just say, he may have been just like some jokes to him again, still one, not interested. So, still, you had to be right outside like that, in front of the building like that, to have a conversation anyway, just. And truth was just possibilities, I wonder.
Yeah, also what's interesting to note is that there's those two security officers there right next to him. There's two cops there, and this is what people say online about people that have gone to that area, that those are Columbus PD officers. There are always cops that clear out the bars at closing time. Hell, even the grocery stores there have armed police at the doors. So it seems like there's a heavy police presence. So would a serial killer even choose to operate with that many security officers or cops around?
One who likes to make a statement, perhaps. But again, if that's the case, why would the body disappear if that would be your goal? I mean, just for you to know that you could have done it?
It's almost like a serial killer likes to challenge himself.
There are those, I imagine, are out there like that, but still, that's...
All right, here's another one of my theories. Okay, so some of these serial killers, obviously, you know, they roofie people's drinks or slip something into their drink. Did someone slip something into his drink in the bar or at a, you know?
It's definitely feasible.
And then it's pretty weird. Another thought I had that I didn't see really being discussed. What if he was targeted for some kind of black market organ harvesting?
That is very true.
Maxwell?
Say that.
Maxwell?
Yeah, I like that too.
Some of these individuals, maybe even attractive women that kind of prowl bars, they would be the perfect candidate to slip something into a guy's drink as they were flirting, and then this other criminal individual kind of gets them out of a back room, back door. Or what if one of the girls were like, yeah, I'll make out with you, just like, let's go out this back entrance so nobody sees us or whatever. And then somebody else is waiting there. They knock him out, put him in a van. Boom, you're getting black market organ harvested. You know, a healthy looking, tall, young looking guy, that's who they would be looking for, right?
Yeah,
yes.
But with that there too, again, as you mentioned earlier, strong police presence. That's an interesting place to pick.
What if, let's get crazy though, what if one of those security officers are in on it? I mean, I can imagine that black market organ harvesting is very lucrative. So to get somebody on the inside, like a cop or security guy, that would probably be on a high list of priorities for people that are doing this kind of work, I would guess.
I consider that too in my thoughts.
If we're going down that rabbit hole. What if it was captured on the security footage and it was erased? And there is footage of him leaving with some guy or a girl.
So with the footage, I imagine would have looked at it. I mean, it would be if it was timestamp footage, I imagine, you know, there'd be a moment where, you know, kind of question why am I missing certain amounts of time.
Okay, very fair point, Sid Irwin. Very fair point. Also, the neighboring businesses wouldn't necessarily be in on it. So it would have to be very close to the bar. However, they said that one of the cameras pans, the other one is operated manually. What if it was turned away from where they moved him? Yeah. Because they knew what time they were going to do that, so they manually moved it there. After he was gone, they might have manually moved it back or not, just so that was never captured.
Essentially, I could see that.
Okay, so let's go through theories from workers at the Ugly Tuna. So this is what people posted online that actually worked, allegedly, at the Ugly Tuna Saloon. Or knew people who did. I know a girl who worked at the Ugly Tuna Saloon regarding the Brian Schaefer case. And she said all the workers over the years since his disappearance have the common belief that he was put through the trash grinder in the back of the bar, which is why he is never shown leaving that bar on camera. I guess this bar is set up strangely, and the trash grinder is not only huge, but it's its own special area of the bar by itself behind a door. I thought this was interesting. Someone responded, "This does sound like a horrible idea, but I worked at a grocery store for 23 years, and not until 2 years ago did they start locking the door to that compactor. Once a day, they would announce it, and everyone would run their trash to the back of the warehouse and put it in under supervision. I think the container was hauled off every 10 days or so. It would have been very easy to put someone in there, and they would be long gone before anyone figured out that that perhaps might be the solution." What do you guys think about that?
That is interesting theory.
That's mind-shocking, but it probably couldn't have been accidental then. So if they got into a fight, if he got into a fight with somebody who worked there, maybe, I don't know, or he was hitting on a waitress who worked there, and her boyfriend was there. I mean, I don't know. It seemed people would witness this kind of altercation. I mean, I'm guessing. I don't know. Maxwell, any thoughts on the,
yeah,
the grinder?
Yeah, I like that. Like, I mean, if there are no clues, there's no CCTV. And the trash compactor or grinder, whatever, is out of the CCTV sites, right?
Yeah, there's no security camera inside the bar. Yes. So there's no video there. Yeah.
Oh, I like that. That went into the number one theory for me. And then the second would be the flirting. And then the third would be what was my third one?
Oh, construction site cover up.
Oh yeah.
I remember your theories better than you. All right, so somebody shot this idea down, however, despite how mind-shocking it is. So again, I'm not sure, I haven't been there, but here's a response to this theory. The grinder at the Ugly Tuna is an actual grinder and not a compactor. It's a really small bar, and they converted one of the storage closets to house a water heater and a garbage disposal. It's a small unit, 4 feet tall. It's obvious that there was no humanly way he could have fallen into it or been fed into it. It's just some sick rumor that got started by a girl, he names the girl's first name, that worked there. A lot, and I mean a lot of the rumors that started came from her. She's what you would politely refer to as an attention whore. All right, so you know what's weird? If the person that killed him, if they posted that comment, that'd be weird. But even if it's a smaller grinder, what does that mean? That means somebody would have had to have killed him, cut him up, and fed him through the grinder in a small period of time. So that does seem unlikely. I mean, doesn't mean it didn't happen. If it was a seasoned serial killer that wants to challenge himself, I mean, I don't know. Okay, so one of the other crazy theories I found is this one. Are you guys hanging on to your hats for this one?
Yeah, I'm ready.
Sid, you ready for this one?
Yes, I'm prepared.
Okay. I believe that Brian went into the bar to sell drugs. He probably was selling to the cooks. I have been a cook, and we all take drugs. He's saying every single cook at every single bar takes drugs. There must be something about working as a cook in a bar. He ripped them off with some bunk expletive, and they killed him in the kitchen and butchered him up after work. What do you think about this theory that someone posted online?
That's interesting. I mean, do they, it's not like any, they don't get micromanaged, right? They pretty much like trusted workers. Right, that
I mean, I would assume it depends on the bar or the establishment, but this theory is saying that there are druggy, murderous cooks out there that don't give a second thought to just cutting somebody up for bad drugs. Sid, any thoughts on this? Let's put your Mensa IQ to use here.
All right, so to establish, I'm guessing it would have to be a sort of syndicate chain to kidnap people. I mean, I'll go along the lines of what you said.
I mean, I don't think he was alleging there was a kidnapping. He was alleging that he sold some bad drugs to the cooks, and the cooks cut him up into little pieces, I guess, and put him in the trash compactor. I don't know.
Could have been possible, though. I imagine we might have checked the trash compactor. I mean, there might have been blood and residues and traces like that.
Actually, that's a pretty good. Yeah, that's a good point. However, the police didn't search until after he was reported missing, which was days later when he didn't show up on Monday for the flight. So this is a couple. So yeah, if they would have had plenty of time to clean up after closing time, and even the whole next day as well.
Even with the bleach, though, well, under certain conditions, they could still check if lots of, you know.
Yeah, maybe, maybe. Yeah, I'm not saying that's likely in any way. I just thought that was an insane theory that needed to be addressed. Let's circle back to Clint Florence here. So, okay, so here's what someone posted up about Clint Florence. As much as it may seem easy to discount search dogs, they are extremely well-trained and naturally can smell things long after a body has ever been removed. A year or so ago, I believe it was an old episode of Mythbusters, did a whole episode on how difficult it is to get by police dogs, especially if you're escaping prison. Some things cause the dogs to take a little longer, but they never got distracted and always managed to find their target. If those dogs were led around the construction site and found nothing, I don't think he's there. I do 100% think Florence knows what happened to him, though. That makes it even more expletive, because if he had something to do with Brian disappearing or even killing him, it's even more expletive up to let his lawyer suggest that Brian just took off. So they're saying that Clint Florence's lawyer was the one suggesting that Brian Schaefer just took off. That's kind of weird, right? As if to get the blame off of Clint. If you're a lawyer, would you do something like that? Doesn't that make your client look even more suspicious if you're throwing blame elsewhere? I mean, it almost seems like it's too obvious, right? Sid, you know a lot of lawyers. Would any of them say that?
I swear to lawyers. Yeah, I guess I have no lawyers. Potentially, yes.
I mean, you don't think that makes it look bad for the client that the lawyer, that the client's lawyer is suggesting that Brian Schaefer just took off and started a new life?
Well, again,
unless it was the truth, if Clint really believes that's the truth, then I guess it's not suspicious. Because if he told his lawyer that, then I guess the lawyer would say that too, right?
The lawyer would say that, though, if they felt their client, they'll say pretty much most anything to make sure that any kind of blame or responsibility would be shifted away from their client, for after all, it is their client they're here to defend, despite whatever the truth might be.
Yeah, Maxwell, what do you think?
Oh, man, I missed that part.
Maxwell Army, you missed every part. All right. Anyone who was that good of a friend would be doing absolutely anything they could to find their friend. Refusing a lie detector when even his dad and brother took one is sketchy as hell. Then the mentions from the other friends that he just stopped contact with any of them, that just seems awfully guilty. So apparently, if this is true, they're alleging that Clint's and Brian's other friends, that Clint ceased contact with all of these people that knew Brian. Does that seem suspicious if that's true?
Yeah. I don't know. I think sometimes people get nervous with these tests because they might.
No, forget the test. Forget the test. We're talking about Clint ceasing contact with all of his and Brian Schaefer's mutual friends.
Shit.
Like, if your friend goes missing,
it could be anything, though. Like, I mean, I see what you mean. Like, that is kind of weird. That you kind of, some people react like that or respond like that because they get nervous or they just shut down. They can't handle it, so they just.
He doesn't seem like he can't handle it. He was saying negative comments about Brian after the disappearance.
That was the same person. Oh, okay.
There's not a lot of people to remember here. There's Brian. There's his friend Clint. I mean, this isn't like an extensive case, Maxwell. There's very few people involved here.
Okay. It's Clint guy. All right.
Sid, any thoughts on that? Ceasing contact with all the other friends?
Is it just that he may have had some involvement with his parents?
So Meredith Reed, the third friend, the girl that gave them the ride, she did take a lie detector test and passed it. Just interesting comparison between how she handled it and how Clint handled it. Although if she's not a drug dealer, then maybe she has nothing to hide. Whereas if Clint is a drug dealer, he might not want to take a lie detector test anyway just because of that. So here's some statements from Clint. We started drinking at the Ugly Tuna Saluna and left and went down the street and back up the street, downing a shot at every bar. Clint said that Brian was extremely drunk. Then Clint said the three of us were sitting at a table and Brian excused himself to go talk to the band and we never saw him again. So that's an interesting statement because apparently when they went back in, they went back in together? Because some people suggest that in the video, he went, if he saw, if he, if for whatever reason, he had a fight with Clint and Meredith, or just Clint, but Clint was with Meredith Reed, and he didn't want to see or talk to them. If he saw them coming out, he wouldn't want to go out the main entrance, so he would have ducked out that other door that goes to the construction site just to avoid them. But Clint is stating here that apparently after the video, they were all sitting at a table and Brian excused himself to go talk to the band and we never saw him again. Clint also stated he was seeing other women. So if that's true, I mean, this is just an account of his statements, so I don't know who reported these, but if that's true, then basically Clint is saying that he was cheating on his girlfriend and routinely did so. But some people think Clint actually helped Brian escape and start a new life. Help him escape and start a new life, would that be a reason to not take a lie detector test? Would that be a reason to cease contact with all mutual friends so you don't have to continue having to face them and lie to them repeatedly while they're worried about their friend?
I'm trying to follow.
No, I'm just currently this process and just think about the possibility of it all.
I'm just saying, if he did, let's just look at it from this angle. If he did help Brian Schaefer escape and start a new life, that right. would explain the denial right. of the right. that right. would expl- right. and that would explain him not wanting to see any of their mutual friends and have to look them in the face while they're
knowing that secret.
Yeah,
there is that chance. True, it makes sense potentially, but in a sense, it's almost cutting off your own life from everybody as well. Just to know that being the case, and that's a big sacrifice right there in himself. He must have been a really, really good friend.
Yeah, it doesn't sound like it from how negative he's talking about him, though. So, like, unless he's talking negative to make people not miss him in his weird, deranged way, especially if he's a drug user and or drug dealer, if he's kind of trying to make it, trying to soften the blow, he might be like, oh, he wasn't that good of a guy anyway.
It's messed up.
There was also...
What? It might be messed up, but it might even be, if that's the case, then it might even be a part of Brian's plan to kind of make it easier for people in a sense.
Maxwell, what do you think about that?
I'm getting lost, man.
I said it like 4 times already. If Clint helped Brian Schaefer escape and start a new life, is that a good reason to not take a lie detector test? And is that a good reason to discontinue contact with all mutual friends? So he wouldn't have. I said that like 4 times.
So if he helped him, but I kept losing it.
And talking negatively about Brian after the fact to try to soften the blow to everybody.
That's not bad.
Yeah, it's kind of messed up. There was also an online rumor that someone said that Clint said that he would talk to the police if he was granted immunity.
And I was about to say, maybe I wanted it in a negative fashion. What if Clint had split out Brian personally?
Yeah, that's messed up. Yep. It does seem that he couldn't have really done it himself just because of the timelines, I guess. I don't know. Without Meredith knowing, because if he was with Meredith, I don't know. Police said it was just a rumor and that this was never discussed or mentioned by Clint. So either they're lying about that or they're being truthful and Clint never said this. And this was a friend of Clint's who just felt obligated to post this rumor online just so people would know that Clint told this to them.
Right.
But the origin of the rumor is unknown. But this is Mind Shock, and we have to upturn every stone in every investigation. So some people think that him and Clint were involved in something illegal, and that they either had some kind of falling out, or that Clint was simply jealous of Brian for all these different reasons. So another theory we didn't go over is if the Ugly Tuna was mob-affiliated. We're going every theory, man. This is Mind Shock. We're going down everything. So there was an online sleuth that posted this opinion. The gut feeling I have is that Brian is certainly not alive. I'm looking at the character of the establishment. I'm thinking that in his state, he could have fallen over that railing behind the rent-a-cops or some second story in the rear. I suspect that the bar owners found out and decided to remove the body and ditch it. Why? To save a lawsuit disaster, to get out of an insurance fiasco. Something as mundane as that. Plus, it would be interesting and would support my idea if the bar is mob-related. I do think some lawyer told Clint to be quiet to save him from becoming a law enforcement target. How sad. They do target people if they can't figure out anything else more logical. I really don't think Brian would disappear and never be in touch with his brother. That makes no sense at all unless the family was highly dysfunctional to the point of seething hatred between them. Isn't it stupid that law enforcement didn't do any forensic work on the establishment at the time of a disappearance? I'm not sure that they didn't, but this is what this individual thought. So if it was mob affiliated, I guess that does increase the chance that they would want to sweep it under the rug, because what do they care? They don't want more eyes on their establishment. Any thoughts on that, Sid?
Personally, I wonder though. So much to do. So much. Feasible. Definitely feasible.
Maxwell, what do you think? If it was mob related, that would increase. They probably wouldn't have a moral issue with covering this up to save some legal trouble.
Because that would just act. I mean, to now definitely explain the potential to have bought off all law enforcement in that area with ease.
Yeah. Yeah. Maxwell, no thoughts?
I like it. Like a mob theory. Yeah, but I don't know.
Definitely yeah, we gotta get those Maxwell's mugs out with "I don't know." That should be your catchphrase.
Are you talking like what kind of motivations would they have to kill him?
Not to kill him. If it was an accident, and it was a mob owned, if the tuna was mob owned or mob affiliated, where they didn't want any eyes. Like, what if they were also dealing some kind of drug
I see what you
if
mean.
If they were dealing some drugs out of the bar or something, they don't want police eyeballs on that place.
Oh, I see. Just to deter any focus.
Or what if one of the guys jealous of Brian who was talking to the girls, what if he was a mobster and he's the one who killed him in the back, cut him up, and fed him into the trash compactor? Mob guys would have no problem doing that. I think that's highly unlikely that it was just some random drunk guy that was mad. But if it was a mobster, then again, wouldn't police have profiles on him so they would know which mobsters frequented the bar? Or maybe not. I don't know. If it was an unknown mobster, an under-the-radar mobster, they wouldn't have issues with chopping somebody up and putting him in a trash compactor.
No, they wouldn't.
So anyway, there's much, much more left to discuss on this case of Brian Schaefer. There's quite a few other avenues we haven't even gone down, believe it or not, that we will have to go over in the next episode. Once again, if you like the podcast, you can donate to our PayPal. Just check the link in the description. Make sure you subscribe to the channel. If you like the podcast, hit the like button. Feel free to share it across social media platforms like our Facebook page. You could also check us out Twitter, Reddit, Patreon. Just check the description. This is Bruce McGuire signing off.
And that's what powers.
It's Sid Irwin.
We'll catch you guys next time.